I am Risa Greenwood. I'm the chair of the Continuing Competence Committee, and I would like to open our session this morning with all of you. It's fabulous to see so many people here, and thank you for your time this morning. I would like to introduce you to our Continuing Competence Committee for the College of Occupational Therapists of BC. Maybe you folks could stand up. Naz Chow is here. Donna Drynan over there. Jennifer Glasgow down at the back there. And Hillary McInnes. So that's our committee. And I would like to just mention that Mary Clark, the communications consultant for the college, has been a huge support for our work and getting us here and organized and sorted for the day. So thanks, Mary. I'd also like to introduce you to Dr. Susan Glover Takahashi. Where is Susan? Sue, who prefers to go by Sue GT just because of that long moniker. Susan is here to co-lead this session this morning. In addition to being the Director of Education and Research for the Postgraduate Medical Education Program at U of T, Sue is also an accomplished project lead for many different kinds of competence types of health professions competence programs, including many for occupational therapy. It's really fun talking with her because she's really developed a real sense of what occupational therapy is all about. She's been an absolute huge support for our committee and this work that we're doing. I'd just like to mention, too, that this session this morning is being audio taped, so if you're shy and you don't want your voice on tape, you may want to pass any questions to a colleague to get up to the mic. Our objectives this morning are here as written. I'll just comment. A big picture piece is for you to have a sense of the broader environment of assessing competence. What do we know about it? How do we know it? And how is that informing our competence program? Just telling you more about how we arrived as a committee at this day and where we are in the process. To give you some sample assessment questions so that you actually get to see them and experience them. And then a really important piece is to invite you to join us. We're going to have some work ahead of us, and you as a group of capable occupational therapists are going to be vital to that process. So those are our hopes for the day. Our continuing competence program launched 3 years ago, and it was in response to meeting our mandate with the Health Professions Act to have a continuing competence program for our college. And the focus of it then remains the same, and that's monitoring and supporting continued safe, ethical, and effective occupational therapy practice. So that mandate has not changed. That's still the focus of what we're trying to accomplish. So we've been developing the Continuing Competence Program, and it has three elements. You'll be a little bit familiar with the first one, which is the maintenance of competence piece, and that is occupational therapists having the opportunity to tell about their competence, to describe their competence, and that was our self-assessment and professional development plan process. So that's a reflective part of the program, and that is the maintenance part. The second element, which is really the focus of today's discussion, is the assessment piece, and that is our ability to show competence. So not just talk about it, but demonstrate it. And then the third element of the program is the what if. So if somebody is struggling with their competence, the ability to support them and help them to achieve competence in occupational therapy. In 2007, the Health Professions Act made some alterations and some wording changes that were pretty critical to us. And one of them is a very distinct increased expectation of having evidence of competence. So it's not adequate any longer just to say, yep, we're competent, trust us. We have to have a mechanism to show that competence. So, as a result, we are working on the competence assessment element of the program. And this is our way of ensuring accountability to the public. And we know that public protection is our bottom line. That's the purpose of the work of the college. And so we need that mechanism to show our competence. And it also has the wonderful side effect of increasing the public's confidence in who we are and what we do. When you go to an OT, you know what you're going to get. So, enough of me describing and talking, and I'm going to turn it over to Susan. She's going to get you going right away with an exercise involving our guiding principles. Sue, over to you.
Thanks. So how many of you have been at one of these workshops in a previous year? Raise a hand. So you'll know that you hope the coffee's kicked in because you're moving from listening to doing. What you want to do is you've got envelopes on your table and we're going to put you to work. There's envelope number one, and you have 5 minutes to read this form and really choose five from the 12 guiding principles that you, from your point of view, think are the most important. Once you've chosen your five, you want to start to have a conversation with some of the people around your table about what did you think was number one and what did other people think were number one. So I'm going to bring the focus back to me. What you're looking through, whether you realize it or not, are some of the guiding principles which Risa and the committee have worked their way through and have been approved by the COTBC board. Can you raise your hand if your table was unanimous about what the top five were? I describe this exercise as choosing your favorite children. All right. This is difficult. Because depending on your point of view and your priorities and the situation, while all are important, what's most important at any given time will vary. So one of the reasons we wanted to start with this exercise is to really give you a very small appreciation of some of the complexity of building a program that meets continuing competence for a diverse group of people from the same profession with multiple stakeholders. And it is a workshop, so we had to have you work. I'm going to then now, over the next 15 minutes, give you a little bit of an orientation to some of the key background. As Risa said, my day job is at U of T providing curriculum and program support for about 3,000 physician specialists in 75 training programs. And if that wasn't enough, I do work with OTs and PTs and dental hygienists, both across the country nationally in groups and sleep occasionally. We'll talk about work-life balance later. We're going to talk about three things over about the next 15 minutes, some definitions and models which have guided our work. Talk a little bit about the factors affecting competence in our work environments, and then really what we're here about to understand some of the guiding principles and decisions around evaluating competence. Three-legged stool, this is a definition that I have constructed based on both my practice and my understanding of the literature, but my view is that to be competent, you really need three things. You need capability, competencies, and ability to function in context. Let me tell you what I mean by that. Competencies, you know. You've got one of these. You've got essential competencies, right? These are the outcomes of performance that are expected of you. So you have those. You know those. What my work with many professions and groups have told us is that where people get themselves into trouble, it's not so much about the competencies part, but about a fit with either their capability or their context. And that's why my definition is a bit broader. Let me tell you what I mean. We've all worked with a variety of people who have capability issues, whether those are longstanding or episodic. By capability, I say we need the raw materials to work in day-to-day practice. We need to be intellectually sound, emotionally sound, psychologically sound, all right? We need the raw materials, right? There's a reason we don't have blind lifeguards. It isn't that visually impaired people can't work. It's just there are some capabilities that are not a match to the job that they want to do. That's true for all of us. There's a good reason I'm not an astronaut. I'm not bright enough. I'm not fit enough. But I'm bright enough and fit enough for lots of things. All right, so capability is the raw materials. Competencies, you know, and context. I might function really well in one work setting with one or many groups of clients. All right, what we know is that the words OBGYN, obstetrician gynecologist, are the same universal. But when I try to move someone who does OBGYN from South Asia, who has no infertility training, into a North American environment where that's a big part of practice, all right, it's about context. In different environments, we ask for different things. And so it's a three-legged stool. It's not one. It's an interplay. Now, who's responsible for supporting practitioner competence? We've been working at this. It's interesting to me because I presented, at those of you that are old and golden, at the conjoint conference on this. We did a tri-joint in Toronto with OT and PT and SLP many years ago, and I presented this, and it hasn't changed. The notion of who owns continuing competence would suggest that there's a single answer. And what we know is that everyone does. As an individual practitioner, we are absolutely responsible. That said, for sure the practice environment has some accountability to make sure that the people that are there are doing a good job. We think the regulatory agency has a mandate, right? In fact, the law says it now. The education community, the educators, have a role to provide new knowledge and share transfer knowledge. We also know that the national professional associations have a huge role in supporting continuing competence. Many people share. The other thing that sometimes people get mixed up in when we're moving into continuing competency work is that they forget that there are many outcomes to the activities that we do as continuing professional development. Sometimes we take courses and read articles because we want to be competent. More often, from my point of view, I'm reading in the areas of interest because they're things I really care about and want to get better at. It's hard to work at the things we're not good at, and I'm not the only one who avoids them. Sometimes our work in professional development outcomes is to advance the knowledge. Sometimes it's about leadership. So there's many different things in this puzzle called continuing professional development for which one of the express or possible outcomes is continuing competence. Continuing competency approaches, the good news or the bad news is that the BC regulatory professions has moved forward on continuing competency about a decade after the multi-million dollar experiments done by many professions across the country. So you have the benefit of all the programs that have failed or are done poorly, the labs that have emerged in Alberta and Ontario in particular. And I say that kind of facetiously, but there is some truth. There has been an explosion of work done in continuing competence to respond to regulatory changes. Canada is ahead of the world on this. First off, our regulatory model is much more robust than many of the models in the US and for sure internationally. I see robust as good. You may see robust as over-regulation. Either way, it's robust. The US approach and the international approach is really a mixed version of doctors are still in charge. A lot of the U.S. boards have professions that are not medicine reporting to medical boards. That's what's really good about audio taping, is that facial expressions do not get recorded. That's one of those situational awareness that I went, okay, good, I didn't use my outside voice. So physician-led models, which doesn't really work for the model of how we want to work in practice in Canada. The other thing is that most of the models internationally are still profession-driven. The discreteness of self-regulation and autonomy of setting the rules for your own profession differently than government or professional association is not that well-developed or as well-developed outside of North America as you might expect. The tools in continuing competence, in my view, don't really matter. What you need to do is decide what you're interested in assessing, what capability, what context issues, what competency issues. Because you can make continuing education very rigid and measurement-like, or you can make it very open-ended. I always do those little self-tests in the magazines. That's a test. Or you can have a test that's more rigorous with structure. So it isn't about the tool. It's about how you structure it. And we need to remember that. So what's affecting competence, and what's with this new fad around continuing competence, or we know it's coming, but why? Well, really, there's three things. The expansion of knowledge in the last 2 to 3 decades is frightening at times and invigorating at others. But clearly, the knowledge that underlied practice 20 or 30 years ago would have fit in a really small bookshelf, right? The number of articles and resources that are guiding and directing and supporting practice has just exploded. Also, number two, the culture and scope of practice has changed. That is, we're working more autonomously. We're working in systems which provide us less support, I would suggest. And the whole notion of autonomy and interaction and who owns which areas really has changed. And then there's those people called clients, you know, that client-centeredness thing. Their expectations, all right? There are two things that have happened, I think, at exactly the same time. We have much more vulnerable populations. At the same time, we have other much more vocal, entitled consumers and clients. And depending on the day or the group, it's either a highly vulnerable person with very little voice, or a very empowered, educated voice. But their expectations of us, much higher. Their criticism of us is higher. There was a day that we wouldn't talk back to other health professions or other members of the team. And yet our culture has absolutely changed. How we expect to be treated, much, much different. We also are much better at understanding what the risk factors are to competence. We know that things like professional withdrawal and isolation are absolute indicators of concern. All right. Sometimes people who have had multiple jobs in a short period of time, that's something you need to be concerned about. Sometimes it just means that they've moved and they're doing a lot of locums. But sometimes it means that they're moving because they can't find a place and they're not staying. People who return to active practice after a period of non-practice, that's a risk factor. A bit rusty, what does the transition to active service look like? If you move from only working in children to working in mental health, are all those competencies the same? Maybe no. Working with vulnerable client populations is really a risk factor. Those that are older, I get more sensitive about this one as the years go on. Those that are older and at later stage of their career continuum, maybe getting a little disengaged with staying up with knowledge. New graduates moving from, I know everything as a graduate to, oh my God, in the workforce. Gender, like heart disease, being a male is a risk factor for competence. They are overrepresented in complaints and discipline. So, you know, like heart disease, it's not a modifiable risk factor in most cases, but, you know, you wouldn't want to say definitively, but really, it is a risk factor. Lack of documentation and adherence to self-reporting requirements. This is fascinating to me. The largest randomized study of physicians, and most of these risk factors arise out of physicians and nurses because they have the largest databases tracking risks to competence. Those people who do not do their paperwork and get their registration in on time and or in their training, as in a medical student or resident, didn't get their immunization records on time, biggest indicator that they will in future in their lives have a complaint and discipline. It's fascinating, but it's about not really paying attention to the details and the rules don't apply to them is the best that we can do from a metaphor. If you've been disciplined, your chances of being disciplined are higher. And if you didn't do that well in the certification exam, it's a risk. Again, I want to underscore risks are not indicators, right? Just because I have high blood pressure, which I don't, doesn't mean I'm going to have a stroke, doesn't mean I'm going to have... It's just like one of those things working against you. Alrighty. Evaluating competence. So you did the guidelines thing. You know this is complex and complicated, and we need to, from a regulatory perspective, have a legal obligation to do two things. We need to balance the fairness of the individual and the consistent standards of practice. So we have principles, we have a lot of tools in the toolkit. We looked at, so what's the purpose of the assessment? What are the processes and standards? How are we going to figure this out? Well, we had the advantage that we had three elements sorted out in your situation, but we were really zeroing in on, so how the heck are we going to do this assessment? The other thing that we looked at is, what are other people doing? What's working? I think what's different in the BC situation, in the BC Act, is the law's tougher. In that it says the college must monitor and really assure that you people are competent, as opposed to the wording of the Ontario Act that the Ontario College of Occupational Therapists needs to meet is they need to establish a program that supports continuing competence. So one's about setting up a program that does one thing, the other is a burden of proof at the individual level. And so there's smoke and mirrors, you can play games, but really, fundamentally, the Act in BC is a bit more tight, in my view, well, having looked at them. So maintain, assessment, and improvement. Tell, show, help. I love those words, tell, show, help, because they really summarize it down to the plain language version of this. So in the first, you're telling the college, I'm competent. The bad news or the good news is that's necessary, but not enough. And if you've done any reading on the self-assessment literature, the incompetent are the least competent to evaluate their competence. Took me days to practice that. All right? But you know that. People have poor insight to their blind spots. We know that about ourselves. I think I'm funny. If I'm not, don't tell me. All right? Assessment, that's where we are, and help. And everyone's nervous about, this is tough. But you don't have to necessarily like it, is the bad news from a regulatory framework. But it really is important to your college and your committee that you be engaged and help build it in a way that's going to work for you. And so we balanced lots of things. And my job as competence assessment expert and someone who helps design competency assessment systems and tests, I work with a team. Like, I'm the front one for a team of other people who work with us, is really to make sure at the end of the day that the college is doing not only a good job for you, but isn't going to waste a whole lot of your registration dollars in court defending something that's not defendable. All right, three-legged stool. And this is where the committee had to work really hard, okay? We've got this big bucket. How are we going to do it? We knew some things we didn't want to do. On the left-hand side, for those of you that can't read the microfiche size font, we looked at lots of things. And we knew which things there was no appetite for. We thought, even though the pharmacists love it, that there wouldn't be an appetite to develop an OSCE locally and run you through all sorts of scenarios. We also had a sense that there wasn't an appetite for something that was going to cost millions and millions of dollars. And what we tried to do is balance must-have evidence and tools that were appealing to how you think and how you work and some of the complexity. Because it's relatively easy. Is Claudia in the room? Or those of you that work on the OT entry-level exam. All things being equal, it's relatively easy to do an entry-level exam because it's like it's about everything at a base level. But then you go into practice and you don't really want to like stay on top of everything. And so that's some of the challenge we're dealing with. We also know that the more choices we give you, if you go to the BC Pharmacy example, they had multiple tools, because they knew choice was going to be important to the registrants. Okay, well, the bad news is choice costs money. right? Because you don't just need to develop one assessment system that's valid and reliable. You need to develop others, and then you need to equate them to make sure you're measuring the same things. So we looked at what were the important parts of practice, and we, meaning the committee, I asked the questions, they gave the answers. And really, it had to pass the nose test. That is, when you're explaining to the government that we're going to let people do a mail order self-attestation that I'm a perfect person, and really that's good evidence of someone's competence, it's hard to really explain that even though you're good people, that there are no people out there that wouldn't rise, yes, I'm really bad, take my license away. So far, we haven't seen too many of those. Alrighty. We also had to decide what's important about competencies. We know, because we live regulation, that jurisprudence is important to us. We do care about consent and boundaries and those things which are really regulatory that we need to attend to. All right. And it needed to meet the principles. And so we looked at lots of tools. Really, the two tools that we looked at the most were multi-source feedback, which is like the Ontario where you get this many clients and this many peers to say, yes, this person's competent in these things. And we looked at a case-based assessment tool, also known as the test. And at the end of the day, we decided on the test. And we'll talk a bit more about that soon after you see some. But when you come down to it, the things that are important are the OT process. All right. And what we know is that clients don't understand OT process because that's magical. It's in our head. It's how we think. It's how we do work. We also know that clients don't know whether we've done good consent or not because they don't know the elements. They just trust that we've done that well. So the sorts of things which were important, and if you're working with clients in the mental health or vulnerable elderly, it's hard to get them to fill it out. We also know having inventoried these systems is that they're hugely expensive. Can you just imagine you now have to fill out forms for everyone there and they have to fill out, like, it just immediately gets to be a exercise. So operationally it's very challenging. And when we looked at the numbers in Ontario, they have a multi-level system. Remember, their program is a bit different. Legislatively, the expectations are a bit different. And they've been able to muster with all of their resources, which are considerable, to do 5% a year. Actually, 5.6. So we know it would take 17 years with the resources that a college like the Ontario OT College has to get everyone through. Again, we know that's going to be a problem. So now you're going to move on to envelope number two. And envelope number two has three sample questions. God bless the committee. They stepped up and said, you know, let's just show them some examples of what the test questions might look like, what the case-based assessment. And so there's packages in there. And for 10 minutes, you're actually going to do test questions. All right. Now, I want you to get through two cases. Pick any color you want. There are different types of cases. One of them is support personnel, mental health, and school-age children. Pick whatever topic appeals to you first. Remember, we always like to do things we like to do first. And then pick a second one that you'll tolerate doing. All right? If you don't like any, still just pick one or two. All righty? 10 minutes. Go. This workshop activity about sample questions is not about the questions. All right, these are very early examples. In fact, our first three samples, and they're drafts. So any of you that have written major papers in your life, these are really early examples. What the committee really wanted to do is demystify, if we could, the sorts of things that might be looked at. The focus is jurisprudence, but as it applies, consent is different depending on the work environment. The key steps are different. And the testing approach, which we're working our way through, is in the literature called key feature cases. Now, we're calling it K case-based, because that's really a bit more plain language, you know, like show, tell. We can give you as many technical words as you want and a long list of articles. But really, key features in the literature allow us to get at some of the messiness and complexity of practice and not drill down to the one perfect answer. Before any case-based assessment, which is high stakes, as in you need to pass, would be launched, all the sorts of good things that happen with any standard measure would happen. First off, we'd have lots of people look at the cases. You run pilot testing, you make sure. So there's multiple layers. But what, from a committee perspective and a college perspective, was we wanted to create some transparency and a visual picture of the sorts of things that might be tested so that it really demystifies some of the anxiety, which is different than, did you find opportunities to improve these questions? Right? This is not a workshop of 84 people critically analyzing how these questions could be different. I'm hoping. All right? It's about, in a case-based way, how do we understand how you apply different principles in different work settings? And we very purposefully chose different areas. And one of the things that is yet to happen is, so does everyone need to demonstrate competence in every context? Or are we going to have registrants focus in a smaller number of areas that they're more comfortable in? And there's plans about that, and Jen will walk us through some of that in a few minutes. You know, you have three samples. Presumably, as you worked your way through your easier to your not so easy to your harder, for most people, I would assume that that was a bit harder. Is that true? You liked the first one better. And the issue is, how do we do the sampling that we find the right spot of getting enough information to know that you're doing, to assure the government and the public, that you're at the right bar in enough areas? And that's really what the competency assessment's about. And I also knew that you needed the answers, because it's just our nature. We are bright and we want to be right. Maybe that's just me. But I saw enough behavior in the room that I think I wasn't alone. There's a couple things that are going to happen. I know I didn't give you enough time on the guiding principles exercise, and you'd really like to fight over whether the right answers are on the page. I know that. But we're going to move to a different activity. And then if there's time left over, you can play at fighting about the guiding principles or about the answers yet again. We're going to go to the reflection exercise. And really, we're looking for some feedback from you individually, and then you're going to talk in the groups. And then most of you may have tripped over this or seen it. It's not a barrier exercise. It's a writing exercise. You're going to individually do the reflection page. That's envelope 3. Talk around your circle around some of your early impressions about these items. Then we're going to go around the table and you're going to share one of the things off of your flip chart. So obviously someone's got to write something on the flip chart and someone has to decide who's going to report what's on the flip chart. So 5-ish minutes on the reflection sheet on your own. Are the scenarios, for example, the sorts of things that actually happen in practice or not? Or does everyone think the questions are way too hard or way too easy? Is there any consensus on anything about those questions that you want to share? I do appreciate that we're giving you a taste of different pieces of some of the journey that we're in, and you'd really like to play at every one of these a little bit longer. I get that. What we did over the last while was take you through some of the general principles. This is a multi-staged program where we deal first with maintenance, then we're going to deal with assessment, and then we'll deal with improvement. The notions of, do you get to choose which areas you're competent in, or do you need to be competent in all, and how we avail ourselves of different aspects of sampling, Those are metrics which, as registrants, you're going to provide advice to the college over the next short while. There will be surveying and input, and it really is important that those of you that are both enthusiastic and critical become engaged in guiding the program, because that's really what this is about. But the notion that you are competent is a taken for granted to an extent, but there will need to be some sampling. The notion that we need to find a way that works is not an option, it's a given. We need to work within what's available and feasible for your college. But there will be opportunity over the next 4 to 6 months, because the college will be looking directly for your input on what do you think is appropriate. And you need to really work with your continuing competency committee and your board around what you think is appropriate. Because you do have a voice, you really do need to share it with them. All right. I am going to hand the podium over to Jen, who's going to walk us through some next steps.